originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and a very pleasant good afternoon to all of you tuning in across the vast expanse of HRRN Nation. Happy to have you with us for another edition of the show Trainers Listen To, Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, you know him as the Pontiff of the Pick Four. We are coming to you from our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios, and happy to have you with us for the next hour here tonight. JT, you know, I was getting ready for the program, and it kind of dawned on me that we might be coming up on an anniversary with Trainer Talk, and I went back and looked, and this show debuted September 26th of 2012, and if you recall, that's when we were at Santa Anita. We had a chance to sit down for the full hour with trainer Ron Ellis, and who knew that nearly 8 years later, we would be sitting here still talking with trainers and talking to them about their lives and their top horses that they've had in their careers.
Yeah, it's really cool that we have so many shows in the can, so to speak. A lot of famous trainers, some not so famous trainers, some people starting out, but it's a big cross section, and it's great to go back and listen to some of those shows and see like some of the people starting out and how good they're doing now, and some of the older trainers that are passed away, and hear about their careers, and it's a great archive of information and history, and been very enjoyable to do these shows.
Yeah, all of those podcasts available on our website, horseracingradio.net. You can go back and listen to that very first show with Ron Ellis in 2012 and listen to all the trainer talks that we've done. They're available for you on our website. But the one thing that strikes me, and we'll get to our special guest here tonight in just a minute, but I want to bring this up. The one thing that strikes me is that all of these trainers have a unique story. Some are similar, but everybody has that one little twist that kind of brings them into this industry some way or another. And even a guy like, for example, Bill Mott, you think about Bill Mott now, Kentucky Derby winner, and all of the accolades that he's received in his career, and well-deserved. It wasn't always like that for Bill Mott. He started like everybody else, and some of the young trainers we talked to on this show, you never know where they're going to end up. And that's one of the beauties of Trainer Talk.
Yeah, well, there's always a common thread running through Trainer Talk is the love of the horse. And that really seems to be the one factor that all the trainers have in common, is that they love thoroughbreds, they love racing. And whether they came into it from their family or they just happened to be walking down the street and one of their friends said, hey, let's go to Belmont Park today. However it is, they all love horses, and that's the main thing.
Well, tonight's guest first joined us on Trainer Talk February 26th of 2014, more than 5 years ago. Since that time, he's added well over 100 wins to his resume, including a trio of graded stakes here in 2019. All three of those graded stakes wins coming with the brilliant mare Come Dancing, who this past Saturday recorded her first grade one victory in the Ballerina at Saratoga. Well-deserved. And the 50-year-old trainer who is our guest tonight is the grandson of a Hall of Fame trainer. His father trained three Eclipse champions, and we could think of no better way in honor of Come Dancing's victory this past weekend to welcome him to the show than with this song.
Come dancing, as Hobby did it when I was just a kid. And when they said come dancing, my sister always did.
How about that? He is Carlos Martin here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Carlos, officially, welcome to the show.
Thank you guys for having me again. Long time between drinks, but I'm happy to be back on.
Yeah, Come Dancing, what a brilliant mare she is. I mentioned that in the intro, but she has just been so good to you and so good for your career. But Talk about that win this past Saturday when she scores in the ballerina.
Yeah, that was an exciting day for everybody, for the whole family. My mom hadn't been to the races for a long time. She came up, my sister, Mark Holliday, Mark Holliday's family. It was just one of those special moments when, you know, Saratoga means so much to us over so many years. I've been coming, I think, since I was like 7, 8 years old. I think it was 77 or 78 my first time here. So it's come full circle to win a grade one on Traverse Day. Doesn't get any better than that for the whole family, not just me. And, of course, very happy for Come Dancing because she's been a grade one mare in my heart from day one, and to actually have it happen and make it a reality is definitely a special day.
What a great job you've done with her, just bringing her along, slowly running her through her conditions and the state bred races, and now a grade one. I mean, just fantastic.
Yeah, no, she's really developed. Mark Holliday's been very patient. We had a little mishap after she run her debut, and she had the pastern injury that Dr. Nixon had to put it back together, and then almost a year later. So it's been a little start and go and trials and tribulations, but she's really come into her own this year as a five-year-old. That pedigree, you know, the Malibu Moon, the AP Indy, the Tis Now line, you know, she's really, really blossomed as she's gotten older.
Yeah, you mentioned her owner, Mark Holliday of Blue Devil Racing, and you mentioned his patience. That has to be, especially in this situation here, Carlos, you can't rush him back, right? You have to take your time with a horse like this that goes through such a tremendous type of injury like that.
No question about it. And sometimes, you know, you give them all the time in the world and things don't work out. But, you know, he's always been that way. The horses always come first, and, you know, very fortunate to have him as a client. As you know, today's day and age, society and racing, everything else, it's instant gratification. And sometimes, you know, you have to wait these things out. The horses, you know, if they're worth the time, you know, they'll show it. But you have to be so patient. And this is definitely a poster. She's a poster girl for that. For doing the right thing by the horse comes first.
Yeah, sometimes it's really hard when you have a nice horse to keep him on the sidelines, but you know deep in your heart that if you take the time and wait on him, that they'll come back for you 100%. And this filly is absolutely just phenomenal. I mean, the way that you've handled her and the way that she runs, and she's so brilliantly fast. I mean, it's amazing that she's had all those things to overcome, and she just is running like she's a 3-year-old.
Yeah, no, she does it in the mornings, too. Everybody's a lot of people, you know, criticize, and they don't know the filly, and sometimes they see the workouts, and they're like, wow, every time she goes out there. But if you see the XBTV, you can actually spend some time with her. You know, she just is routinely brilliant. She doesn't look like she's even in a high gallop. She's going in 47, galloping out in 59, galloping out in 12, galloping out 7/8 and 24. And there was a few little things I was hearing as I was getting her ready for this race, and I said, listen, come out, watch out for your breezer. And you can see for yourself, she's not under the whip. She's not being driven. She's just routinely a brilliant mare. And as long as she's eating good and doing good, I've got 6 weeks to get her ready. We got her back from Bruce Jackson's July 10th. And I was comfortable with that. Mark was like, 6 weeks? That's all it takes. I said, listen, she's a brilliant mare. She gets a lot out of her gallops. With 4 workouts, we had her almost ready to do the same thing in the distaff when she came off from Ocala Stud 5 months. So, you know, there's no substitute as a trainer or an owner or anybody. If you know your horse, just stick to what works. And Javier came and made a commitment to us, and he was there every Sunday like clockwork, and it worked out great. She trained brilliantly and ran to it.
Sometimes those fillies, they like to just do their own thing. They kind of want to train themselves. They don't want to be held. They don't want to be, you know, snugged down. They want to be free and just run along, and they're much happier that way.
No question about it. She's a filly where, like I said, if you see him just put his hands in the back of her neck, just letting her do her thing, she doesn't like even look like she's running, and she's just so brilliant. But she does it so easily. It's you're like you know, thinking about back to my dad when he had Groovy, and he said, "Listen, good horses are going to work fast, and if they do it, and you're not beating them up, they're not under any kind of pressure. They're just brilliant horses." And you're right. Sometimes you stay out of their way. You know, you try to slow them down too much, and then they get hurt and they throw off stride and balance. It's not easy to have a 1,000-pound horse that's like a Come Dancing or a Groovy. You're going to tell them what to do all the time, as long as they're doing it willingly, they're happy, they're sound, they're eating up. Those are the main signs you look for. You know, as far as they're going to go a little fast, yeah, they're going to go a little faster than your average horse because they're grade one type of horses, and that's the kind of stuff you have to give and take. And, you know, in between the works, you try to do a little bit less, or you try to mix and max as far as how much you do in the galloping during the week. All that stuff you pick up after, you know, Jude knows because he was in every kind of fast in the industry after experience of many years, you know, doing things with the horses. And hopefully when your gut tells you something, you go with your gut, and if successful, you keep doing this, you know, trying to repeat the same patterns and don't change what got you there.
Well, Carlos, I mentioned this was the third graded stakes victory for Come Dancing here in 2019. You had to know going into the Ballerina, or at least have a pretty good sense that she was Breeders' Cup caliber. Now she punches her ticket to the Breeders' Cup officially. She gets that win in your end victory. How important is that for you looking ahead to the rest of the campaign for Come Dancing to have that in your back pocket now?
Well, it's very important. You know, it just takes a lot of pressure off when you accomplish something great. And, you know, for the whole team now, you know, we can sit back in a perfect world. If they leave it to my own devices, you know, I'd probably like to wait and just keep her fresh. And she's fired so well for us in the past. And the Breeders' Cup hopefully will be a culmination of a great career. And, you know, I know it's still early to see what's going to happen because you know how this business is. It turns in a dime on you. I mean, in a perfect world, she goes out and wins the Breeders' Cup and gets an Eclipse Award as the Filly and Mare Sprint Champion, which I think she would if she can finish it off. I think that would be as much as she deserves that she's owed us. You know, she's done more for us than we could ever hope for, and she deserves to go out a champion. And I would probably want to see her go and have a great life at Lane's End and make some beautiful babies and call it a career. I think she's done enough.
Let's go back to the early part of her career. You mentioned the injury after her debut. She won that debut, a maiden special weight at Aqueduct in 2016, and then she has to go on the shelf. When you brought her back more than a year later at the end of 2017, when she's going to the gate, what's that like for a trainer, knowing what she had to overcome? I would have some serious butterflies. How about you?
Well, yeah. I mean, she's been special from day one, so anytime she runs, you have butterflies. I didn't have as many as I thought going into this race just because things have gone so perfectly. But you always have butterflies, of course, especially after that kind of injury, running her back, and it was at the end of the year at Aqueduct. You know, you'd be a liar if you're not human nature. You really love these horses, and you put everything into them, and they give you so much that, you know, after a major injury, you have three screws and a pastern bone, you know, you definitely have some trepidation and butterflies right till she comes back to the barn safe and sound. And then we try to bring her back to the Interboro a month later for first start of her 4 years, and kind of had a little wacky thing 3 or 4 days before with the Naira and the power and this and that. It was like 10 degrees, and something happened with her that day. I couldn't really pinpoint it. She just seemed like she might have got tied up behind. She just wasn't right. Like, she wasn't lame or anything, but you could see, like, she was just a little hitchy behind. I'm not sure. She might have even tied up in that race or something weird. Then Mark said, listen, we know she's a great filly. Let's give her more time. And then sent her back to Ocala Stud for another 3 or 3.5 months before I got her back in July of last year at Saratoga to start her campaign over again. So there's definitely a lot to be said for what we just spoke about, patience and more patience. And, you know, it's just been an incredible journey with her.
How'd that relationship with Mark come about?
Dr. Galvin had been a longtime vet of ours for years. He had worked on a lot of the Flying Z horses. And about 10 years ago, Mark was getting a little bit bigger in the game. He had been in the game a few years prior with Dale Romans and a few horses at sales and just started getting the bug. And I met also with Mark's nephew, Andrew Wolf, and he spent a week with us, you know, going to the track and seeing the horses. He was doing like a little internship with Dr. Galvin. And next thing you know, I guess, I don't know if he did or Dr. Galvin, they both recommended me to train a horse or two for Mark. And the rest has been history. We've had some good times and some good success and mutual respect for each other.
Yeah, it's always great when you get a new client that understands the game and wants to operate on a high level, have some Saturday horses, as Mr. Kilroy used to say. And this has certainly been great for you. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
You know, by the way, talking with Carlos Martin here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Carlos, she was a $200,000 purchase as a yearling. Did you have a hand in selecting her, or was that before you kind of got involved?
No, we bred her, David and Gordo. I put them together with Lane's End with Mark
good.
Years ago, and they bought a few nice, really nice select high-end mares for commercial aspect. And Tizza had her mother that won the Demoiselle for George Weaver back in the day. She was presented at Keeneland, and I don't think they were getting the action they thought they would get. She's a big, beautiful mare, but she's a little bit offset, crooked in the right front, you know, from the knee down. And then they said, you know, we're not getting what we should be getting here. We're going to be in trouble here at the sale. And they took her out of the sale, and they scratched her from Keeneland. They didn't sell her. And then they sent her to me to see what we can do with her.
Oh, good. Okay. All right. I didn't realize that part of the story. That's good. So when I was getting ready for the program, I read an article about her running in the Ruffian, which, of course, she won back in May. And you were talking about how Ruffian was one of your favorite horses. So to win a race like that, a big graded stakes named in her honor, what was that like?
Yeah, it was awesome. I mean, Ruffian is one of those things, you know, growing up in the sport, the romance of it, and unfortunately the way it ended, but just her sheer beauty and watching her power. And, you know, Ruffian is like my Michael Jordan growing up, if you're a basketball fan, to that kind of degree, how much reverence I had for Ruffian. And when I won that race, it was really special. I had picked up in a charity event, I don't even know, 20, 25 years ago when I won the older Philly American Championship with the Philly I claimed many months ago from Steinbrenner called By the Firm in Ocala. We were doing one of those events for the trophies, and I wound up getting like a Richard Stone Reeves of Ruffian, and I have it right in my office. And I put the winning picture all these years later of the Ruffian would come dancing right next to it in my office. So it's really cool. I mean, you can't ask for more of a storybook ending from my standpoint. You know, Ruffian will always be, I think, the greatest filly, or maybe one of the greatest horse that ever lived.
So growing up in a racing family, you've seen a lot of fantastic horses run in your lifetime. Is she your top, your number one?
I'm sorry?
Is she your number one favorite horse?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, she is. I mean, I love Dad had Groovy, who was exciting. You know, he got him after he was a laughing stock when he beat in the Derby. And he said he's going to make him a champion, and everybody thought, you know, Jose Martin's lost it. He went up winning 12 out of 16 and winning 2 4-goes and, you know, making him an Eclipse champion. So Groovy was a fun time, of course. And in 81, when he had Noble Nashua, who was a brilliant, brilliant horse by Nashua, that won the Barbaro Cup and ran a 33-mile in the Jerome, was probably the freakiest talented horse that I was ever around. But, you know, Ruffian is, like I said, I think she's something that I always just grew up, I gravitated to her, you know.
We'll talk more about your dad here in just a minute, Carlos, but I want to go back even further and go back to your grandfather, who is a Hall of Fame trainer, Frank Martin. Tell us a little bit about your grandfather.
The amazing man, you know, tough character, but a great heart, helped so many people for so many years at the tracks. He came over from Cuba with the whole gang. I think Louis Blue, who trained the Belmont winner with Summing, and Lasbar, who trained the Affirm the Triple Crown winner. They all grew up right around the same neighborhood in Cuba in a place called Marianao, and they were all together as friends, and they all came in, and they all became pretty successful trainers. Louis, Laz, Oscar, my father, my grandfather, they were all in the same boat. And, you know, he came here with nothing, and he made himself a great success. I think the first real thing he did on the map was, I think he claimed the horse that won the 1959 Wood Memorial, named after the famous fighter Jack Dempsey, Manasseh Mola, and he beat a very good meadow stable horse that escapes me. I don't know if it was first landing that Wood Memorial year. And it was a $100,000 race back then in 59. I think then he was on his way, and he was able to win the title 10 straight years in New York. And, you know, I think the coolest story that I remember as a kid, I was probably only like 5 or 6 years old, but I remember him buying or claiming the autobiography from the Phipps. And Mr. Neloy, you know, another great Hall of Fame trainer. I think the horse might have had a tendon or might have had some kind of injury. He brought the horse back. Then the following year he won the Jackson Club Gold Cup, and Phipps had to give him the trophy. So those kind of memories stick out. You know, he did some amazing things with some horses that other people just gave up on, or he would always get a well-bred horse, and, you know, he'd work on them and work on their legs, and he was tirelessly dedicated. That's one thing about him. He'd be up at 4 o'clock in the morning, he'd have his coffee, he'd be at the barn at 4:30, and he'd be at the races all day or stay at the barn all day, and he just really loved the horses and loved tinkering with them. And a lot of people tell me, you know, they know him a lot more than even, because I came around a little bit later, and I spent a lot more time with my father, even though in the late 80s, when my dad passed away, unfortunately, way before my granddad, I spent a lot of time with him at the end, too. It's just a great man, great story to listen to, and just the dedication is the main thing you take out of it. I mean, the guy was, till the very end, he was going to the barn 7 days a week, you know, spending as much time as he could with the horses, and, you know, he just knew the insides and out of the horse. McKinley, the great farrier who does the quarter cracks for us, who helped me actually come dancing before the Ruffian. I think he was telling me a story the other day when we decided to do the gluons with her for this race. We decided to go on with some gluons because she's got some Shelley walls and feet. McKinley said, I don't think that there was ever a horseman like your grandfather. I said, what do you mean? He said, we were back in California 20 years ago, and he's asking me for wire and stuff. And he cut a quarter crack out and put the patch and put the wire like better than I would have done it. He said he did amazing things that he never would see another horseman do, just with feet alone.
Yeah, those guys were amazing. I met your grandfather through Laz, who was kind of like a second father to me. And man, oh man, I used to love to listen to them cut up. They would just rip one another to shreds, but it was all in fun, you know. But just fantastic. And he was a great man. Those guys from that era, they had to know how to do everything because they didn't have blacksmiths with fancy trucks at their disposal all the time, you know. So we're kind of spoiled nowadays that we have all these things available. But you know, I know Laz. He learned a lot from Buster Milrick. Buster Milrick was like his idol, and you know, it was one of those things where they had all these little secrets, all these little things that they would do that have now all gone by the wayside, pretty much.
Yeah, so it's a different game now. You have four or five top trainers that control all the horses, and they're mega trainers, and they're great. They know what they're doing, but it's different. You know, they're managing such a high operation. They're a part-time trainer with the top horses, and then the other 100 or 150 they have, you know, they're managing them, which is great. You know, they have great organizations. I give them credit. I'm happy with 25 or 30 horses, kind of hands-on, and I never really thought about getting any more than that, or I want to be able to see what's going on and try to at least be able to feel every horse's legs every day and just the old school stuff. And a lot of that is gone. It's just a whole different era and a whole different game. Back then, when my father and my grandfather had a lot of horses, there was a limit, stall limits, this and that. When my grandfather was leading trainer for 10 straight years, there would be 40, 44 was the limit, and everybody would want to give him more horses. He'd pass them on to Gary Gullo's dad or any other friends, and everybody would kind of share and eat at the same time. You know, nowadays you have, you know, five or six guys that have 300, 400, 500, 600 horses. So things have definitely changed from that aspect. But you have to be content with what you have, and I'm happy having the stable I have, and I want to be able to do the job where I feel comfortable, that I know that I'm doing the best I can with what I have to work with, and every horse is getting as much attention as they can possibly get.
What do you remember about the day that your grandfather was inducted into the Hall of Fame?
Boy, it was like a little bit of a blur. You know, it was, I think, 1981, so I think I was like 11 or 12. So, I mean, I remember it was a great day. We all got, the whole family got together, and it was just, you know, it's special. You know, you look back at those memories, but like I said, it was, I was still very young. I didn't probably grasp it at the time, what an honor it is. I go back every year, just go through the Hall of Fame and see his plaque and stuff, and it's definitely a proud moment every time I see his name up there in the Hall of Fame next to all the other great legends of the sport.
Where does nickname Pancho come from?
That's a good question. I never even asked or never even wondered, but that was definitely his nickname. That stuck for till the very, very end.
I think Poncho's just like a nickname for Frank, you know.
It could be.
Yeah, oh, really?
Yeah, okay. It's just Francis and Frank, and then Poncho would be the Spanish version, you know. So.
Well, Frank Pancho Martin was indeed inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1981. We are visiting with his grandson, Carlos Martin, here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. And Carlos, you know, you mentioned Groovy as being one of the top horses that your dad trained, and certainly was. He trained a few different Eclipse champions. But outside of Groovy, what are some of his other horses that really jump out to you when you think back on your dad's career?
Well, he was always good with the fillies. He had a lot of luck with fillies, and he would take a lot of fillies that, you know, they weren't that well bred, but he would, you know, mold them and make them champions. I mean, of course they had ability, but he would, you know, was just really had a special way with the fillies. I mean, he won a couple of Demoiselles. He won a couple of coaching clubs. He had the filly in 77, Lakeville Miss, that wound up being the two-year-old filly champion. And as a three-year-old, I think she might have been the champion also if he would have kept her. He sold her for a lot of money, him and Mr. Weinzer. She was no pedigree, I think, by Mr. Randy, out of a Blue Prince mare called Hen, or I don't remember exactly, but it was not a pedigree at all. I think he ran her actually from maiden 25 the first time, and then probably she's probably the only horse in history that didn't run in anything but staked after that. I think literally no allowance, no starters, no handicaps. She went from maiden 25, 1/5, and then ran in stakes the rest of her career. As a three-year-old, when she won the coaching club, Peter Brandt and Mr. Whiteley Sr. gave up $500,000 for her, which back then, you know, it's a big score. So I remember the story like it was yesterday, not to compare my father with Mr. Whiteley. We know what a legendary trainer he is, a Ruffian and Damascus and all those great horses. But just to go back to the same thing when you have to know your own horse. So my dad, you know, was a young trainer back then, and he wanted Mr. Whiteley to do good. They just paid $500,000 after she won the grade one coaching club. And he'd give him the pieces of paper. You know, he'd give him, like, some notes on the filly. He had her since she was a baby. And then the old black groom that would work for Mr. Whiteley back then came back the next day and said, Jose, Mr. Whiteley says he doesn't need anybody to tell that trainer horse. And they ripped up all the pieces of paper. And then they got her to Saratoga with a Cinto, and I think she worked like five bullets in a row. And the poor girl never made it to the coaching club. She got hurt, and they had to retire her. And then years later, she produced, I think, the champagne winner, Magambo. But even as great a trainer as Mr. Whiteley was, you know, every horse is a little bit different. So my dad was trying to give him some good advice, and he didn't take it. Now, who knows? Things happen. But just the moral of the story is, you know, no matter who it is, there's no substitute to knowing your horse.
Yeah, that's a little bit presumptuous too, because I'm sure you know, wait, you claim a horse off somebody and you think you have all the answers, and then you find out they weren't as stupid as you thought they were, right?
You better believe it.
It's happened to me a couple times.
Carlos, I'm going to ask you what they say you shouldn't do during an interview. I'm going to ask you a two-part question here. What are some things that you do similarly to your dad, and some things that you do completely differently from the way your dad handled his operation?
I don't know about differently completely. I think that I can be a little bit more aggressive at times, maybe than my father was. He was a pretty conservative trainer. I think maybe I would maybe shoot the envelope a little bit more. Like, I've done some crazy things the last few years, running horses back off short rest. I don't think he would ever do something like that mainly. I think he was more like he would like to space his horses more in between the races. I've claimed a horse here from Brad Cockett to meet. You know, great trainer, one of the top trainers in the nation. Just hit the shot back 7 days, you know, hoping he would come off the turf. It came off the turf. We were lucky enough to win with a mare we just claimed from that chair called Jen Emily. You know, and I've done some of those things over the course of time. You know, years ago I had a horse from Mr. Lizza. I think I ran him four times at the meet in Saratoga, and he won all four. You know, I think those kind of things, you know, you do some things that work out. You know, I've never been afraid of doing and thinking outside the box a little bit. I don't think my father would be running a horse four times in a 35-day meet, and you know, thank God we won the four races, and the horse turned out did very well for us riding on the wall. So maybe a little bit more aggressive from that standpoint. But as far as training the philosophy, you know, you have to go by gut, and every horse is a little bit different. And I think, you know, he taught me that. Obviously, you know, you want to be able to zero in, and the best trainers, if they can get into the horse's mind mentally and physically, and then they can tailor a program to them, as opposed to maybe just training them all the same, is obviously a lesson that I learned years ago from watching him.
What do you think your dad would have said if he was standing there with you when Come Dancing crossed the finish line first in the Ballerina?
I think he would have been proud. You know, he wasn't a man of a lot of words and stuff, but, you know, he probably would have gave me a hug and said, you did a good job. But he probably would have been two sentences. But I would have hopefully seen, you know, in his face, you know, the pride of, you know, developing a filly, you know, especially after all the success he had with fillies. I think he would have liked that.
Yeah, that's, I'm sure he would have that. It's phenomenal how you have your parents with you at some of those races, and you remember those moments when you see the look on their face when you win, and you know that they really appreciate what you do.
Yeah, no doubt. It's a special feeling to be in the same business and then to carry on the name. Unfortunately, my father and my grandfather are no longer around, so that gives me inspiration. You know, whether you have a $10,000 claim or you have a Come Dancing in the barn, you still want to be on top of your business and get up 7 days a week and try to be dedicated. And it's the only thing I've ever loved. So that gives inspiration also to keep the family name going, because it means a lot to me.
Yeah, he is trainer Carlos Martin, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Carlos, stay with us. We're going to get to a short break. We'll come back, and we'll talk about some of the other top horses that you've had the privilege to be around throughout your career. There have been many. We'll talk about them next, right here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Nominations are now open to the Fasig Tipton November Sale, the world's premier breeding stock event. The sale annually produces the highest average and median of any mixed sale in the world, and in 2018 sold 22 horses for $1 million or higher. Held the Monday after the Breeders' Cup, this one-night sale offers leading racing and broodmare prospects, proven producers, and selected yearlings in the most electric atmosphere you will find at any thoroughbred auction. Nominate your best today, the Fasig Tipton November Sale, where stars shine brightest.
Bloom Racing. Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Pulling away from Come Dancing, Mopetism, and the others, Midnight Bizou leaves no doubt today. She won the FIPS in hand.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now, get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
you try Daily Racing Form Saratoga single-day bundles? Get everything you need for the day, including DRF BPs, clocker reports, DRF Plus Pro, and Timeform US betting strategies. DRF Saratoga single-day bundles are available with your choice of Classic Formulator or Timeform US BPs. So now you can maximize your handicapping any day of the meet with DRF Saratoga single-day bundles. Visit drf.com/Saratoga to learn more.
Talking with Dr. Jim Chiappetta of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, why focus on the nose? Isn't the throat a big problem in racehorses?
Mike, when we think about the upper airway in horses, we typically end up putting on a tongue tie or operating on its throat to improve airflow. What you may find interesting is that when we measure the anatomy of the upper airway and the flow, the narrowest part that causes the greatest resistance in all horses is the nasal passages. That's where the strips work. If you want to improve airflow to the lungs, you need to consider the nasal passages.
Learn more at flarestrips.com/learn.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Come Dancing is moving on the outside of Me a Mischief. Separation of powers put to the test on the inside starts to give way. And then comes Special Relativity and Dawn the Destroyer on the outside. Come Dancing comes to the eighth pole. She's got a 2.5 length lead. Dawn the Destroyer next toward the inside and third. It's Special Relativity. Come Dancing. Oh, she came running today. Despite that start, she waltzed home. Come Dancing won it by 4 over Dawn the Destroyer. Special Relativity was third in a final time of 121.48.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, and our Jimmy Johns of Lexington broadcast studios. That was Larry Colmus with the call of the Grade 1 Ballerina this past weekend on the Travers undercard at Saratoga. Come Dancing, you heard him reference the slow beginning, but boy, did she come rolling at the end. She wins officially by 3.5 lengths, punching her ticket to the Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Sprint. For trainer Carlos Martin, who is our special guest here on Trainer Talk tonight, we'll continue this visit with Carlos right after we remind you that you can go ahead and visit horseracingradio.net to check out the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows. They're there for you, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. She was impressive, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, her record's great, and she came out of the Ogden Phipps against Midnight Bisa, and she stumbled at the break, and she might have been able to run even a little better in that race. It was just a fantastic turn of events for her in the last 3-4 races.
Well, Carlos, like all of our guests who appear on Trainer Talk here in the month of August and into September, going to receive a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors, that is Flair Equine Nasal Strip. So we will send those to Carlos, and we rejoin him now as he joins us from New York. Carlos, welcome back to the program. And you know, you have to, when you hear that call, I know we talked about Come Dancing a lot at the top of the show tonight, but when you hear that call from Larry and he references that bad beginning, as you're watching that unfold, what's going through your mind in the beginning of that race?
You know, you're so zoned in that you don't even, I'm not even really, I'm listening to him when he says that she came to dance today and she's waltzing by 5 at the very end. Like, take a deep breath. But that's probably the only words that really that really resonated with me, to be honest with you. I'm just keeping an eye on her and seeing how comfortable Javier is. Even with the start, you know, it was fine. It worked out.
All right, let's go back to the beginning of your career, and we'll talk about some of the other top horses that you've trained, so many other greatest stakes winners in your career. But what, obviously coming from a racing family, this was in your blood, but was there ever a time when Carlos Martin thought of maybe going a different direction with your life and your career?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think I got the bug, like I said, fairly early. I went to the coaching club in 77 with Lakeville Miss One, and it's just such a special moment with Dad. And I think pretty much then that day, 1977, when she won the Grade 1 by 6 with Ruben Hernandez, I think that kind of, that was in my mind that I think I really want to try to see if I can really be with the horses.
Does it ever put any extra pressure on you, having your grandfather in the Hall of Fame, having your dad be such a famous trainer? Do you ever feel like you have to carry the mantle and it sometimes gets a little tough?
No, I mean, I put pressure on myself because I want to do well. And, of course, you know, having that last name, you know, you don't want to let anybody down. But also, in the same token, I also just try to just do the best I can. If I did that, and worried about, you know, my father, my grandfather, then I'd probably drive myself crazy because I'm never going to, I mean, honestly, I'm never going to live up to their expectations or my expectations of trying to be like them. It's just something that doesn't really come into play. Maybe in the beginning of my career a little bit, but, you know, I've been doing this a long time now. You know, we've been lucky enough to win almost 700 races, almost 30 million in purses. I got to stand on my own. And, of course, when they passed away, Mr. Lizza passed away, my father, my grandfather, losing all of them, you know, in a relatively short period of time, you lose your mentors, and you always have them to kind of back up on, and it's like they're a safety net in a lot of regards because you can always have somebody you can talk to about anything. So once all that, you know, unfortunately, the way it turned out, and, you know, it's like you're out there and you have to make your own way. And I was doing it when they were still alive, but it's a lot different when you don't have your, you know, some the key people that you grew up in the sport. But it's good. I'm proud to still be in the business, and, you know, honored to have, obviously, Martin is the last name, and hopefully some good things to come in the future.
Over the course of the 7 years now that we've been doing this Trainer Talk show on HRN, Carlos, we've heard stories from trainers that started their careers quickly. Other trainers, it has been more difficult, and they've gotten off to a slower start, and they've had to learn and grind, and then eventually things click, and they end up in a very good position, and they're still training many, many years later. Go back to your first year or two of training horses. What were those years like for you?
They were exciting. I think I got a little spoiled. Came up with some nice horses right away. I claimed a filly from Steinbrenner. I think he was changing trainers like he was changing managers at the time. I claimed an Affirm filly, you know, called By the Firm for $32,000. We were able to win the Grade 1 Top Flight and the Long Look and the Carousel and a lot of other nice races. We were able to sell her for $500,000 to Mr. Klug, owned unaccounted for, the great horse that he had with Schuhhofer. So, yeah, I was a little spoiled. Had her right away. Had some other really good horses, you know, early on, you know, like Moonlight Martini, who won a couple of nice stakes for us. Stacy's Toy, who won the Pimlico Oaks, who also, I think, in my second or third year of training, we sold her for $500,000 to Arthur Appleton at the time. So I was rolling. And then you find out how difficult the game can be. Then you lose owners, and some of them, you know, pass by the wayside. And then, you know, I kind of got myself, you know, always wanted to be with Mr. Liz and Flying Z. And then after the first bunch of years when I was doing pretty good on my own, I kind of was more with my father and Mr. Lizza and wanted to be more like a private trainer for Flying Z, which was great. It was good for me, I thought, at the time. And then after, unfortunately, when he passed about 8 years ago, it's like starting all over again.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When you go back to Equibase and you look at your yearly statistics, you are one of the most consistent trainers, I think, that we've seen in the game. Every year, you're right around that same number of victories and the same number of purse earnings, and everything continues to click. But you had a stretch from 1993 to 95 where it was a bit of a struggle. You had six wins over those 3 years. What was going on at that time in your career?
I probably blocked it out, to be honest with you. I probably don't want to remember it.
I'm glad I brought it up.
you know, it's just like anything. I think probably we might have had some owners that probably, I think we might have some key people that weren't around in the business anymore. And we were, Mr. Liz, I think, was going through a transition where he was selling a lot of the horses. He switched over. I don't know if he got divorced at the time or something. And there was some kind of transition where the stable was like in disarray or the continuity wasn't there. I think it was because of a few of our main owners. I think there might have been a divorce going on at the time, or there was some kind of switch with the Flying Z horses, and I think that might have been that year, if I'm not mistaken.
All right, I'll spin this the other way for you then. You come right back in 1996 after that bad stretch, and you win 33 races in 96, and then ever since then, you've been ultra-consistent. So in 1996, what was the key to getting things rolling again?
I think Mr. Lizza, I think, was the key. I think he gave me a really good filly called Thunder Achiever that I was able to win some really good New York Bred stakes with. I think we won the first flight handicap that year with her. We beat Miss Golden Circle. I did a crazy maneuver. I had gotten beat a week earlier with lots of talk on showcase day. And then again, you know, I took a shot. I think my dad thought I was nuts too, what Mr. Lizard did. I said, we're going to run her right back and we're going to take a shot in the first flight. And Kimmel had a really good filly at the time for his dad called Miss Golden Circle. And we were able to take a shot with Robbie Davis. We ran 121 in change, and Thunder Achiever, you know, was a great day. And then I think after that, you know, we got things kind of going again a little bit.
Yeah, sometimes it just takes one race like that to really right the ship. And I'll tell you, those divorces can be tough on a racing stable. I had that happen to me, too. I know that's not good when your best client gets a divorce, and then 3 years later he calls you and tells you, I only have enough money to claim one horse for Del Mar. And my banker's trainer is Mike Mitchell. So I'm not firing you, But that's my only choice. I said, well, you just go for it, you know.
Wow. So, yeah. Not easy.
Not easy.
Well, you do have to – look, Carlos, you got to have your big boy pants on if you're going to play this game and be in this profession, because they talk about it all the time. It's a sport with the highest highs and the lowest lows. So I'll ask it to you this way. How do you maintain your confidence and your faith in the way you're training horses and what you're doing when times aren't going so well?
You have that confidence and faith because of experience. You know you're going to turn it around as long as you stay with the principles that got you there and everything you learned. You just didn't forget how to train when things aren't going, you know, well. Unfortunately, as Jude knows, it's the cyclical business sometimes. You can have 3 months where, you know, you're winning ruffians and ballerinas, and then you go 6 months and you're 2 for 100, and you're saying to yourself, everything's going the other way. Your horses are getting hurt. They're getting sick. Owners are taking horses away. And you, like you said, you have to have your big boy pants. So those days do come, and everybody can handle success. But a lot of people cannot stay the course in this business. You see great trainers for 3 or 4 years, and then all of a sudden they're out of the business. That's the key, who can handle the adversity when things aren't going so well. And that's something that either you have that and you can do it, or if you don't have the mental makeup, then you obviously you're going to fall apart pretty quickly in this business, because what you just said is true. The highs of highs and the lows of lows, and you win a grade one, and the next day you come to the barn happy, and the horse can't come out of the stall, and the horse is retired. And those things happen a lot, and worse.
Yeah, you see, you know, in the news every day, trainers that have setbacks with their horses. I mean, this year, I think Richard Mandel is kind of like the poster boy with Omaha Beach this year. I mean, every time he'd show up at the barn, the horse had something going on. So, you know, it's heartbreaking sometimes. And a lot of trainers don't have the luxury of having enough horses to, you know, carry the rest of the stable. They just have a few, and if one of their good horses gets hurt, it's tough sometimes.
Oh, no doubt. It's definitely a tough game. There's no question about it. And what Mike said is true. Unfortunately, it's like anything else. Only the strong survive.
Yeah. And it can be an extremely rewarding profession, too, as you know. You talk about the high points with a horse like Come Dancing, who wins the Grade 1 Ballerina. You mentioned the Top Flight with By the Firm. Tell me a little bit more about By the Firm, because was able to win a few greatest stakes for you, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, no, she was a great mare. Well, like I said, I think Steinbrenner was a little bit in disarray himself. He had been giving her to different trainers. I think George Gianos, who trained Pistols and Roses, had her in Florida. And then she wound up with Howie Tesher in New York, and we just saw an opportunity with a well-bred, you know, filly by a firm out of an old Tartan family mare intentionally, by the hand, by intentionally. So for $32,000, we didn't think we'd go too far wrong. And I think they had sprinted her the day I took her. And then the first thing we did, I think I ran her right back. Like on 6 days rest, she won, and then did the same thing again, like right back. I think we might have won 3 races with her in 24 days, something crazy like that. And we just stretched her out, and she just got really good on us.
Do you think more trainers could get away with doing that, running horses back on short rest?
I mean, years ago, you know, the horses back then, I guess, I don't know if it's different to breeding or stuff, but they definitely used to run a lot more. I mean, now I guess for the top horses, you know, it's politically incorrect to run them more than 5 or 6, 7 times a year, and I'm guilty of that with Come Dancing. I mean, it's also you're also dealing with certain races. You're not going to run a grade one horse, you know, every week. So it's a little bit different from that aspect. But, yeah, do people take less chances, especially some of the high-profile guys? You know, nobody wants to be criticized. And with everything that's going on, unfortunately, in this business with some of the things that have gone on in California and stuff, you know, people think it's, no, you're killing the poor horse running him back in 7 days. But it just every situation is a little different. That's how I feel about it anyway.
Yeah, you got to use everything that you know. And your gut sometimes is the best indicator.
No question about it.
Yeah, I mean, the horses, they're born to run, and when they're ready to run, you know, you run them. How much do you think, Carlos, that the economics of the game have played into seeing horses make fewer starts nowadays?
I mean, I'm not sure exactly.
Yeah.
I think every client, you know, has such a big influence, especially all these partnerships and stuff. They're great for the game. But I think the trainers are so micromanaged these days. It's hard to get a guy like a Mr. Lizza or like Shug has with the Phipps or Lane's End. And these people really go back to another day and time where, you know, the trainer really was, you know, he was his call. I mean, people would love their horses. They wanted to be involved. But the trainer made the calls for Come Dancing or Code of Honor, and they never were really questioned back then. You know, nowadays it's like, you know, everything's by committee. So things have just completely changed all around. I'm fortunate. The few really good owners I have, like Matt Shara and Mr. Collinsworth and James O'Reilly and Mark Holliday with Blue Devil, they still kind of go back to those old principles. Of course they want to know what's going on, You know, they're not going to be like my grandfather when he was 10 straight years leading trainer for Mr. Somer. I think the only reason the guy knew his horses were in, he'd have to pick up the paper. That's another extreme. But, I mean, just everything is different, you know? I mean, you have some owners that want to run more than I want to run, too, that go the other way. But it's just to find that that balance is the most important thing, and to find the balance for the horse. Some horses can take that kind of stuff, and they can run back quick and be successful, and some of them can't, and you try it. Doesn't work out, you try something different.
Yeah, that's funny. I had to tell my brother to get in the harness business. I said, you want to run your horses way too much. Get in the harness business.
We are visiting with trainer Carlos Martin here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Carlos, you mentioned the name of the late George Steinbrenner and being around his horses and training for him. Who are some of the other notable people, famous people that you've had the privilege to meet in doing this job over the years?
I think I had a lot of fun back in the day meeting people like Cab Calloway, you know, the famous singer. He was a big racing fan, and he was good friends with my father and my grandfather. I think he was an interesting guy to meet. And then, of course, you know, with Cordero, he would take us to the fights, and people like legendary fighter like Wilfredo Gomez and Sugar Ray Leonard. And I was always a big boxing fan growing up. I did a little bit of that when I was a kid. So, yeah, there was always some interesting characters around the racetrack. There's no question about it. You know, Jerry Cooney, the boxer, had a piece of By the Firm when we claimed her from kinsman Doug Cooney, the fighter, with Mr. Mara from Northport, Long Island, a Long Island guy that my dad had a lot of success for, and then I wound up training for him. So Jerry Cooney was in on that partnership. You know, a lot of definitely interesting people over the years.
You know, Ron Moquette was a boxer, too. You ever get a chance to talk to him about it?
No. I really don't know him that well. I know he's a... seems like a cool guy, and I know he's had a lot of success, but I really have not talked to him too much. I think it's just a little bit of a different circuit right now that we're going through.
Yeah. Would that be your favorite sport outside of horse racing, boxing?
I always loved basketball, college basketball, horse racing, boxing. Those were always the things I really enjoyed watching growing up. You know, I was a big fan of the Knicks, obviously. I was born in the year. The last time that we had any success in 69, so I always had that hope. And then every year I kind of was disappointed. So that's a labor of love being a Knicks fan, especially in the last 10 or 15 years since Dolan took the team over.
Yeah, that's a tough row right now.
Who's your favorite college basketball team?
I loved St. John's growing up because I remember going 1985 to the Garden, watching Chris Mullin go against Georgetown and Reggie Williams and those kind of games. I always loved those kind of games, and it was exciting at the time. St. John's was a great team with Coach Carnesecca and Walter Berry and Ron Artest and Chris Mullin and Bill Wennington. I remember those days and going to some great Garden games and the festivals. I always enjoyed that time of year and always enjoyed St. John's and, of course, the great Kentucky teams, Duke, you know, that everybody hated Duke back at the time. But, you know, you couldn't help but love, you know, a guy like Bobby Hurley out of Jersey, watching him play, and that year with Leitner and all those great players. I'm a fan of just talent and heart. And determination in college basketball really exemplifies that at the high level. When those guys get there, I can kind of, not that hard work, is a little bit of a different type of hard work, but that dedication to be at that level.
Mentioning Duke and Christian Leitner in the same sentence, you may not want to make a trip to Keeneland to come dancing this year.
No, yeah, that one little game spoiled everything for that love affair, right?
Yeah, there's not too many Duke fans around here. They run them out of town.
Yeah, they drag them out, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Do you get to go to any St. John's games now?
I went to one game this year. I've just been so busy, but I went to one game at the arena. You know, it's such an intimate setting over there at the Carnesecca Arena. It was cool. I think they came back. I forgot who they beat. They beat a team. I think it was Loyola, one of those teams. It was a great game. They had that one really great guard. I don't know if he'll make the NBA. He's a little bit light, but he's a really dynamic player, of Shamari Pons. And I saw him. He scored like 33 that night. So it was fun. And Mark Holliday with SL Green, you know, he runs the biggest realty company in Manhattan. So once in a while, he'll get us those courtside seats. And, you know, even when they're losing, there's nothing like being at the Garden for a game. So that's always exciting.
Yeah, that's got to be great. That's going to be a thrill.
How about your family now? Are they involved in your operation in any way?
My sister is pretty much involved. My younger brother does a lot of the bookwork and stuff, and he handles like the stable at Belmont now while I'm here. He's always been kind of, you know, involved in his own way. He loves the game also. He's also doing other things, but he's always kept a pulse on racing. My sister, you know, she's, you know, been obviously a student of the game, and the last 5 or 10 years she's got more and more involved. About 10 years ago when Mr. Lizard passed away, she helped me with the business, and she became like the racing manager, and you know, she helped keep everything in order. She's been, her and my sister and my brother have been a big part of our success. And Gloria still, you know, loves the game. She married a nice Jewish attorney from Long Island, Charles Walshine, so she's a little bit more doing some more law stuff than horse stuff at the moment. But she's always had a dream to get a pinhooking partnership together, and she's, I think, after all, she's been working on it for a couple of years, and she's got something in place where she's going to try to launch something to do with, you know, like a farm where she could have, you know, some horses at the farm and some yearlings and then also pinhook horses. She's got a lot of great ideas. Hopefully they'll get off the ground for her.
Yeah, that sounds like good for her and good for you. It could be a great family business.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, this show, Carlos, obviously sponsored and has been for a long time by our friends at Fasig Tipton. Will you spend much time around the sales, whether it be the yearling sales or the older horse sales, whatever it might be?
I used to do a lot more of that back when Mr. Lizzo was alive. He used to love to go every year to Keeneland, and we'd pick out horses together. I haven't done as much of that. I have a few more breeders now. But the last few years, I started doing a little bit more than that. I have a new client from Texas, Mr. Collinsworth, who really loves the game. We won a little race here with him with a Spikestown horse called Potomac. And actually, I think Sean Fell, is that your son or your nephew?
It's my nephew, yeah.
Your nephew, Sean, I met him, great young guy. I know he's got a great reputation, a great record. So it's ironic enough, I met your nephew. We started talking about a couple of weeks ago one evening, and I really, you know, I know a little bit about him, and I'm probably going to have him work with us and shortlist some horses for Mr. Collinsworth. Going to go to Keeneland, going to try to pick out some runners, and hopefully we can pinhook a few. So we're going to try to get that going for that one client. And then, you know, I've been buying some yearlings here and there for different clients. I picked up a little yearling New York bred colt for $45,000 out of a new sire by Spiketown, the one the Breeders' Cup Mile that McLaughlin trained for the Arabs. He's got the funny name, Muta something or other, but he's a nice horse. He won the Breeders' Cup Mile, and I picked up that colt out of a Medaglio d'Oro mare. So I'm always looking. Then I picked up a summer front privately for Mr. Collinsworth, and now we're going to hopefully buy 10 at Keeneland, and Sean's going to be part of the team, so I'm excited about that.
That's great. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, Carlos Martin with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on HRRN. All right, Carlos, let's take you down a bit of a trip down memory lane here. I'm going to mention the name of a greatest stakes winner that you've trained, and you can go ahead and tell us the backstory behind that horse. And we already talked about By the Firm, so I'll go with Rousing Past.
Interesting. Very interesting horse. Probably the best bred horse that I'm ever going to get to have my hands on. And my dad, too, at the time, was instrumental with Mr. Liz in acquiring the horse. Billy Badgett, good guy, good friend of ours, had him for Christiane at the time. What I remember, I think he was out of Tinglestone. I think she was a pretty good mare. I think grade one stakes winner at the time. I think the horse wasn't running that well. We got the hold of the horse, and my dad used legendary blacksmith Ray Amato Sr., who I think at 80-something years old still does some of Todd Pletcher's work, believe it or not. And they found a blind quarter cracks, got the horse sound, got him to win the bold ruler, and turned out to be a heck of a nice horse. It was a real runner.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's great when you find something like that that you can fix right away and turn the horse around. Right?
Yeah, no, he was a hell of a horse. Unfortunately, I think they tried him on the grass after the bold ruler, and he had been running in some big races. And I think he had a bad, he hurt himself on a grass race and never ran again. But he was a real, real, real good horse. Big, beautiful horse by Damascus out of Tinglestone, was a real runner.
Yeah, won the grade three bold ruler in 1991. 5 years later, in the grade two first flight handicap, you send out a horse by the name of Thunder Achiever.
Yeah, New York bred. That was one of the ones I was telling you about, Mr. Liz, a homebred. And she was a running mare, big, beautiful chestnut mare. And she had gotten beat by Lata Talc, I believe, the time before that. And then everybody said, you're running back right away in the first flight. I took a shot with Robbie Davis, and she beat Miss Golden Circle. And she was a great, great, great mare. She was a great New York bred mare, and then she was able to win some big open races. And I remember, like, it was yesterday. I think my dad had her as a two-year-old before I got my hands on her. We were going back and forth with Mr. Lizard, kind of switching horses back and forth at the time, depending on who was doing better with which horse. And I think my dad had a five-length lead with Bailey. Saratoga in a maiden special weight. Bailey got to whipping her. And I think she put her tail up in there, and she got beat. And they were all so depressed. I remember, like, it was yesterday. They came to the barn. It looked like it was a funeral because they thought she had a lot of talent. How could she lose a maiden race? And then I forgot. I think one of the racing managers from Mr. Liz or some people from the farm said, yeah, you know, you got to teach her. You got to beat her, you know, whip her more in the mornings or something. My dad said, please. My dad used some few choice words. I think her next few starts, before we turned it back around, I think he actually took the whip away from the rider. So those kind of things kind of stick out in your mind.
Yeah, I bet you they would. How about Renewed?
Harborview Farm, people that were really close to us growing up that I really, really enjoyed being with them, great people, but I wasn't training for them at the time. We had a crazy old guy. Murray Guerin was a character, Damon Runyon of the sport back then, and we claimed the horse for $25,000 just because I knew so much about their pedigrees. I think he was by Lost Code at a Roberto Mare, if I'm not mistaken, and I just loved the breeding. I said, for $25,000, Murray, I think we got to take this horse. So we took the horse. He made me run him, of course, because he liked to run 87,000 times a week. So he made me run the poor horse all winter on the dirt. I think I was getting beat 10, 15, 20 lengths on the dirt. I said, can I just please? So finally, mercifully, the grass came and the spring came. And we got him on the grass, and he turned out to be a nice horse. We won the Lawrence Realization, I think at 40-1 with Filiberto Leone. I think Neil Drysdale had a nice horse at the time that was the heavy favorite that we beat. And then I think my dad, Murray, had gotten sick. And my dad did some negotiation with Thoroughbred Corp. And I think Murray said, man, these vet bills are killing me. My father said, we just won a $200,000 or whatever, the Lawrence Realization. He says, the vet bills aren't killing you. Something else is killing you. And we got him to laugh a little bit. And then he signed the paperwork. Renewed went on to Wally DeLossi. And I think he did okay for the Thoroughbred Corp. But, yeah, he turned out to be a nice horse, a nice claim. And I think we got a lot of money for the horse at the time after he won that mile-and-a-half race.
Well, just about 3 minutes left in this visit with trainer Carlos Martin on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Carlos, I'll give you two final names, Van Minister and Roar Emotion.
Van Minister was a horse that was almost like my second father owned, Billy Terrell, who ran the Van Company at Lorraine and Ebert for many, many years. And his dad, Red Terrell, was a great guy, great trainer. The train turned back the alarm. And we got the horse for Billy. We were able to win the Hill Prince. Really, really nice horse. He beat that day, I think, a horse that went up going on to win the Breeders' Cup years later. From Marty Wilson and Live Oak, one of the approval horses we beat in the Hill Prince. And then after that, I think Van Minister went off behind and stuff. But he was a fun horse, and I think Mike Luzzi rode him for us at the time, and it was definitely a great win winning the Hill Prince. And then Roar Emotion was a filly that Mr. Mara bought with Joe Brocklebank, who's still buying horses to this day. I think they didn't pay more than $27,000 for her by Roar, and she won her first race in brilliant fashion. Joe Allen stepped in and bought her for a lot of money. And then my dad had gotten sick the next year, and I was able to keep the mantle going, and we were able to win the Black Eyed Susan with her, and she won the Demoiselle for my father the year before, a big, beautiful mare by Roar that could really, really run. And I enjoyed winning the Black Eyed Susan. I think Bob was winning everything at the time. He had the heavy favorite that day, Santa the Catalina, and we were able to beat her that day, and it was a rainstorm, and I never had such a great day getting wet all day at the Black Eyed Susan that day.
Well, Carlos, it's been quite a ride for you, and you know, you're holding up that family legacy extremely well, and we can't thank you enough for spending some time with us here on Trainer Talk this afternoon. It's been a delight to hear your story and look back on some of those great horses with you.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me, and appreciate you guys, everything you guys do for the trainers and the game, and bringing the good stuff that the sport has, so many good things also.
And you're part of that. Carlos, we appreciate the visit. We'll send you those flare strips, and all the best moving forward.
Take care. Thanks, guys.
All right, trainer Carlos Martin here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. You know, one of those guys that we talked at the top of the show, that many trainers have gotten into this game through family. Many trainers have gotten into the game when they had no family in the business. And he's one of those guys that came up from those family roots. And he is upholding that legacy extremely well.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, his family legendary, really, in our sport. And it's nice to see that, you know, he's as down-to-earth as he is.
Yeah, and Come Dancing on her way to the Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Sprint, virtue of that victory in the Grade 1 Ballerina this past week at Saratoga. We wish her and Carlos Martin all the best, and our thanks to Carlos for being part of this program here tonight. Don't forget, if you missed any portion, head to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast and follow us on social media at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook. For our producer, Lee Delapina, for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next week on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton.